Hey, everybody, it's Scott Burnside back for another episode of Two Man Advantage, the podcast. As usual, my trusty sidekick, Pierre LeBrun in Toronto. And a great treat today to start off this first segment of Two Man Advantage. Jaina Heffert joining us to talk some women's hockey, a member of the 2018 Hall of Fame class. Congratulations on that. And the interim commissioner of the Canadian Women's Hockey League. Jaina, this has been a busy 4 or 5 days for you and a lot of discussion about the future of women's hockey, not just in Canada, but really around the world and certainly in North America. And thank you for joining us to chat about what's ahead.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Well, I guess obviously the first place to start, maybe if you could walk us through, Jaina, the process that led to the Canadian Women's Hockey League deciding to cease operations. That announcement came out Sunday morning, a few days before the start of the World Women's World Championship, which are taking place in Finland. What led to that, and maybe what you see as the next step in keeping the growth arc of women's hockey on the upswing?
Yeah, you know, it's, as you said, it's been a pretty difficult few days and certainly a few weeks. And coming off a season that we felt like we really grew the game, we put it in a really positive spotlight. We tried to increase the visibility of the women and the great stars that we have. There's so much momentum and excitement around the women's game right now. But in all of that, it kept bringing us back to our model and how we were going to advance the game from here. And, you know, I think there's kind of two elements to it. And one part of it is, you know, on the business side and sort of generating revenue. And we all know that revenues need to exceed our expenses. And we generate revenue through sponsorship, through donations, through ticket sales, merchandise sales, and we simply weren't getting, you know, we weren't getting the support in those areas to match our expenses. And the women's hockey is such a growing sport, and obviously the climate of female sport and pushing women's sport is there, but we weren't seeing it in the tangible ways we needed to. And the marketplace just simply wasn't responding on the revenue side. And then the second part of it is around, probably more specifically around our model and being a not-for-profit. And we're under an RFC AAA status, meaning a registered charity of amateur athletics association. And under that model, we really can't pay athletes any more than a stipend. And as we look to ways that we're going to advance the game, I believe the women deserve so much more than they're getting. And most of the athletes in our league make a few thousand dollars a year, which really is, it barely covers expenses and gas costs and equipment and stuff like that. So, you know, we have a long way to go in advancing the women's game and advancing women in sports. And we just felt like under this model, we weren't able to push the game forward. And we certainly believe that there's great opportunity and great potential down the line. And we're really trying to push for those opportunities to come. And there's been a number of organizations and that have stepped up and said they believe in women's sport, they believe in women's hockey, they have a desire to see it grow. And we're really hoping that at this point, in this you know, pivotal point in the women's game, that people step up and support it in real tangible ways.
Yeah, that's really well said. And just really, for me, shocking news when I saw the news Sunday, and especially given the type of year that it's been. I think back to, you know, what played out at the NHL All-Star Game in San Jose. I was there, and, you know, I've got two daughters who play hockey at Leaside here in Toronto, Jaina, and you know, I feel it every weekend in minor hockey rinks, the explosion of women's hockey and girls hockey and the path that surely it seems to have. And yet we have this news this week, and it's just really heartbreaking. And I guess the question I would ask is, you know, not that the NHL is always the place to go to get all our answers. But I just feel like, you know, given the history of the NBA with the WNBA and that kind of path, if you feel that long-term down the road that there hopefully can be some kind of a association, a real meaningful association with the NHL to get this whole thing on track.
Yeah, I've said this all along that I think, you know, somewhere down the line here, the NHL does play a big part in the growth of the game and in advancing the game. And that's simply because of the resources they have, obviously the financial backing they have. I mean, when you talk about the NHL All-Star Game and you see the way the athletes performed, and I can tell you, we probably have 10 players in our league that could have done the same thing. Mm-hmm. And until people were able to see it on that platform, people didn't realize how good the game is and how great these athletes are. And those, you know, that's something that, you know, that brand creates that. And as hard as we try, we can't put the athletes on that sort of platform, certainly not in this model. And that's where I see the value. And of course, we want someday, you know, goal for me is that these women will have a living wage. And we can debate what a living wage is, but it's certainly more than a few $1,000 a year.
Jaina, one of the sort of ongoing elements of what is going to happen next and how things unfold, of course, is, you know, the presence of the National Women's Hockey League, and the fact that in the wake of your group deciding to cease operations, that they announced that they would have two new teams, one in Montreal, one in Toronto, moving forward. Sort of piggybacking on Pierre's question, it has always struck me that the NHL has been very cautious about sort of wading into how best to forge a relationship between the NHL and a women's pro league, given that there were two leagues. And now that there's just one, do you think does it change that dynamic, or does there still need to be a resolution? Okay, what is women's pro hockey going to look like moving forward? Or how do you see that part of it unfolding?
Like I said, I certainly believe the NHL plays a role in that. And whether you're talking about our league or the NWHL, the players are not, being paid the way we hope at someday they will. And that comes down to a lot of things. It comes down to generating revenue in the marketplace. It comes down to getting people in the stands. And, we didn't see that support at the level we needed to continue to advance the game. And I can't speak for the NWHL at all in terms of how they see it. But I believe the game just deserves so much more, and the players deserve so much more. And I think it's such a pivotal time, and we have to push for change. And I believe in why we're doing this. And I believe that, the players deserve more.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, when you see the TV ratings for, you know, the women's Olympic gold medal game every 4 years, you're like, surely you're thinking there's got to be a way to channel this so that it's not one moment every 4 years where it feels like, I'll be honest, once again at the last Olympics, I've got way more interest in the women's game than the men's game in that Olympics. But then, you know, 4 years go by and you know, there clearly weren't enough people buying tickets to go see games, in the CWHL this year. And that's the frustrating part, is how does that translate, right? I mean, do you feel like you're banging your head against the wall sometimes?
Yeah, you know, it's extremely frustrating. I feel like there's a real big disconnect in how, you know, we see those players on the biggest stage in the Olympics every 4 years and potentially World Championships once a year. Mm-hmm. And we have an incredible attention, and you sell out arenas. Doesn't matter if it's an NHL arena or not, if you know teams play. And and you know, the rivalry series, for instance, there was 40 players on the ice and 29 of them were playing in the CWHL. And the excitement around that, but it doesn't translate to the local market level. And, if we are truly trying to advance the game and truly trying to create a professional model, this just, it wasn't doing it justice.
Yeah. By the way, shameless plug, but the Women's World's on TSN coming up here. So I should mention that.
Always good to get that plug in. Well, Jane, I'm curious, and I don't know whether, I know Pierre mentioned the WNBA and their relationship with the NBA, and that's something that has had its ebbs and flows over the years as well. And I wonder if you have an idea of what, in a perfect world, what does the model look like? Is it a direct relationship between, the Toronto Maple Leafs and the Toronto Women's Pro Team in that city, the Montreal Canadiens and the team in Montreal and so on, in Buffalo, on down the line. Is it that kind of tight relationship like that? What does it look like to you in a perfect world where you don't have these kinds of discussions, where you get to a point where the players are paid an appropriate salary and the game's profile continues to grow and grows exponentially because of the connection?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to speculate too much because I don't know what next steps are, but I will say, you know, when we look at other women's pro sports, if we talk about the WNBA, they have that NBA infrastructure behind them. If we talk about women's professional soccer, my understanding is US soccer is a big piece of that infrastructure. And we didn't have that behind us to support us and provide the resources we needed. So certainly that's where someone like the NHL would come in to provide that structure. All I can say is, you know, in terms of the teams we worked with, they're great partners. And of course, I'd love to see, you know, I live in Toronto and I know MLSC has been a strong supporter of CWHL. Of course, I'd love to see a team that's, you know, affiliated to them because they are great proponents of the women's game. But I don't think at this point I can speculate too much what that looks like. You know, obviously you'd have to talk to Gary about that if it ever got to that point. But, you know, I believe that infrastructure is critical to a women's professional league.
And before we let you go here, Jane, thanks again for joining us. But, of course, your official title was interim commissioner. And I'm just wondering where all this leaves you now in your professional life as far as next steps for the recently inducted Hockey Hall of Famer here.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this was all, you know, relatively sudden to me, too. So I'll see where it takes me. I mean, I will always advocate for female sports and women's hockey and certainly push for what I believe, you know, the players deserve. And hopefully that'll, you know, I'll be able to remain in the hockey world on some level. But I don't know. I'll probably take some time to figure out what that next step is.
So, and just again, before you you head off, I think there's been a lot of discussion since the announcement on Sunday that suggesting that maybe this is one of those hard decisions, these hard things that had to be undertaken so that something better can grow of it. Now, maybe that's Pollyannish, maybe it's naive to think that, but I think there is this belief that women's hockey is growing in popularity. The profile is changed even in the last year or 2 years. And I wonder if you believe that that's the case, that this hard decision was necessary for something much bigger and better to grow out of it, in spite of how difficult it might have been for you and the rest of the board.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe that's me being an idealist, but I completely agree with you. I think anytime, you know, something, you know, some real big change has to happen, you gotta muck through the muddy water sometimes to get there. And this has been difficult, and it's not something we ever wanted or thought would happen, I don't think. But it keeps coming back to me. You know, I'm comfortable with this because I believe in what we're trying to do, and I believe that there's more out there. I believe that and optimistic for the future and those opportunities that future female hockey players, Pierre, like your daughters, and I have a daughter, and you know, there's better opportunities out there for these women to be you know, respected for what they do.
Yeah, that's so well said. For sure.
It's I want to ask about the world, though, before we let Jaina go. Now, Jaina, it's been a while since you've actually played, but these are, and I've been following the reports from Finland as the tournament gets ready to kick off there, and certainly the tune-up games, as you and Pierre alluded to, you know, lots of interest and lots of popularity. What's it like for you to watch sort of from afar now as a former player and as we've mentioned a couple of times, as a member of the Hall of Fame? Do you get nervous still watching, or what's your take on the 2019 Women's World Championships?
Yeah, I'm excited to watch it. And I had a chance to do a bit of the rivalry series, the panel discussions. And so it got me, I guess, a little bit more involved on a deeper level, aside from just the entertainment part of it. But You know, I've had a chance to stay close to a number of those athletes and people that I played with still, you know, 5-6 years ago. So I have an interest in it for sure. As a fan, I feel like it's such a pivotal time for the game, and coming out of the rivalry series, I think for Canada specifically, I think they've got a new sort of aura about them, a new level of confidence. And, mm-hmm. you know, they've struggled over the last number of years, certainly, but I'm excited to watch what's going to happen here because I think they gained a lot of confidence coming out of that series, and we'll see if they're able to maintain that going forward.
Very good. Well, as Pierre said, thank you so much for taking some time to join us today. And I'm sure it won't be the last time that we impose on you, and certainly won't be the last time in the coming weeks and months that we talk about the future of women's hockey and what's next and possible relationships with the NHL and all that. So thank you very much for hanging out with us today.
No problem. I appreciate you guys having me.
All right, my friend. That's very interesting. I've been curious what you think of, you know, because the NHL has been very, you know, so they're in a bit of a difficult position on this, right? Because they don't want to. I know in the past, both Gary Bettman and Bill Daly have been very cautious about not wanting to be seen as sort of imposing their will on women's hockey, especially when there were two professional leagues. Now, of course, there's just one. But I think they've made it very clear that the leagues had to sort of work it out themselves, and then the NHL sort of would see beyond that. Is that fair to say? And maybe how do you see it getting resolved as we move forward now that the CWHL is no longer in existence?
Yeah, I don't know that it changes all that much in terms of how the NHL is going to operate right now, because there still is another league operating. And, you know, when I tweeted yesterday that the league was now going to take that $50,000 sponsorship that it was giving the CWHL and just add it to the 50 grand it was already giving to the NWHL, and so it'll be 100 grand now, people really freaked out on Twitter because... because they couldn't believe, I mean, they thought there was missing a zero on my tweet, and I get it. It's not a big sum of money when you consider the revenues of the National Hockey League, but I think it underlines, quite frankly, and this is my own opinion, it's not, you know, anything that the league has told me, but this is my read on things. I think it tells you that the NHL doesn't really think that the NWHL has a very good business model, probably, and probably felt, you know, unfortunately the same about the CWHL. And the point being, and maybe I'm naive here, but I think that what the NHL is probably planning long term is that if the NWHL also folds at some point, that's the NHL's window. That's when the NHL says, okay, you know, let's put together something with structure here and let's have a women's league. That's really right. That's my thought on it. I could be wrong, but that's what I think the NHL is keeping, you know, itself back for right now. And I mean, listen, I get it. I'm sure there are a lot of things that people around the hockey world wishes the NHL would invest in, but unless the NHL is controlling it, I don't know how comfortable they are in doing that. Right. I mean, that's right. And you know, and it does give a lot of money to both USA Hockey and Hockey Canada, which I think we need to say this ends up helping girls hockey everywhere on both sides of the border. So it's not like they're ignoring the sport, but I understand why people reacted the way they did yesterday, because 100 grand is pocket change to the National Hockey League. So it's not really helping the NWHL a whole lot. So we'll see where it goes from here.
Right. But man, I'm, you know, is it the, I guess there is, and you're right, like that, the backlash from, oh, okay, well, we'll take that $50,000 that we previously were giving to the CWHA, we'll fold it into the NWHL, and there you go. And people were, you know, outraged, although, you know, I guess I would ask, is it the league's place to be, you know, let's say, what's the number? Okay, here's $1 million. Well, the league doesn't control the NHL, it doesn't control, they, you know, that it's not their league to look after, right? They look at their... They have a job, I think, to look after the sport as a whole. And that means Olympics. It means international hockey. It means grassroots hockey everywhere. It certainly means women's hockey on some level. But mm-hmm. to prop up or support a pro women's league. I'm not sure that's their, especially since it's not their side. I think it's a bit misguided to suggest that the NHL should be doing that. So
yeah. Now, on the other hand, I mean, I will certainly hold the NHL's feet to the fire if the NWHL ever does fold, and then it doesn't do anything about bringing together a women's pro league under the NHL umbrella. I think if that moment in time ever happens, it really behooves the NHL to take that leadership role at that point in time.
Agreed.
And this is where I have had my disagreements with the NHL over the years. The idea of the fact that there's a difference sometimes between what's good for the actual sport, but not necessarily good for the bottom line of the NHL. Sometimes those two things aren't aligned. Sometimes and you know where I'm getting at. I'm talking about Olympic participation and the league's decision at this point not to be in the Olympics anymore. I really struggle with that. I know you do too. And I understand the NHL's position that after all these years of being in the Olympics, that they don't believe there's a direct benefit to their bottom line. That may actually be true. I'm not disagreeing with that. But that doesn't mean that there isn't an unbelievable benefit to what's best for the sport of hockey, and that's having its best male and female players in the Olympic Games every 4 years. Those are two that happen to be two different things, perhaps. And so I guess what I'm getting at is this, Scotty, is that I don't know enough about the NBA and the WNBA to understand how that's all worked over the years, but my very superficial knowledge of it is that, you know, the WNBA hasn't exactly been a huge moneymaker, that it's had its financial issues. But I would suggest, and it's naive for me to say this because it's not my money, but for the betterment of the sport, I think the WNBA has been tremendous. I think it's hard to deny that. And this is where I would say that one day, if the NHL is in a position to have, you know, a WNHL, whatever you want to call it, that I would hope that the initial judgment of it would not immediately be revenues and the bottom line, but to have a real long-term view of it in terms of an investment, and to understand that, you know, the ramifications of how huge that would be for women and girls everywhere, and frankly for everyone, period. So anyway, sorry, I'm getting a little rantish here, but I mean, that's sort of where I'm coming from on it.
I love it when you get rambunctious, and I think it's absolutely true. And I think, and again, the NWHL, will do what it's going to do. They'll do what they believe best. If at some point they and some of the, whether it's Jaina or whoever it is from the remnants of the CWHL, if they sit down in a room with Bill Daly and Gary Bettman at some point and say, okay, let's put all this aside and let's try and do something that works for the NHL and for women's hockey. I'm with you. Like, to me, it's an exponential thing. If you do it properly and you're under the NHL umbrella, then it does. It's about growing the game right from the very bottom. And I think we talked a lot when we were talking with Jaina about the growth of women's hockey and the excitement of youngsters who wanted to be like Kendall Coyne Schofield after the San Jose All-Star game, and who watched the women who took part in the skills competition demonstrating both this year and then a year ago in Tampa as well. Those are hockey fans, and they can be women's hockey fans and they can be NHL fans. And I think the more that you grow that group, then the better it is for everyone. And it, at some point, it should be good for the NHL too. So,
yep.
There you
go. I hate when we agree. That's the scary thing.
I know. I feel kind of let down about that. But I tell you what, let's do this. We'll take a brief break. We'll come back for the second segment of Two Man Advantage, the podcast. And I can almost guarantee we will disagree about several things when we start talking about the final days of the regular season, the opening of the playoffs in a week. So I'm pretty sure we'll find something to butt heads against. How's that sound?
I guarantee it.
All right, my friend. So, okay, I have to ask you, if you were to give me the temperature of angst, can angst have a temperature? Let's assume that there can be an angst temperature. What do you say the temperature is 1 to 100 in Toronto now as the Leafs stumble their way towards the end of the regular season and what is now assured a second straight first round matchup against I've talked to several people. There may not be mighty, but they're an imposing Boston Bruins team. What's the temperature of angst in Toronto right now?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Leaf fans have known for a while now in this city that this was going to be the series. So it's not like it's creeping up on them. And you know, listen, it's not been very appealing defensively in terms of what this Leafs team has looked like in their own end in the final weeks of the regular season. A lot of that, of course, could be attributed to not having one of their top four blue liners and Jake Gardner, who appears to be on the mend. But, you know, ups and downs. I mean, I think Monday's win against the Islanders on Long Island was well-received, with John Tavares scoring the winner and all the history behind that. But that was more of a blip than what's really happening. I mean, this is a Leafs team that doesn't quite have the swagger it probably should for the talent that it has entering these playoffs here. And that's why, interestingly enough, I love the fact that Mike Babcock came out yesterday, which was Tuesday morning. I was at the skates and said that Frederik Andersen would play both Thursday against Tampa and Saturday against Montreal, regardless of the fact those games are meaningless for Toronto in the standings. Because it's about preparation for Frederik Andersen. I mean, the Leafs, I don't think, will open until next Thursday at Boston. So timing-wise, it makes sense for the starting goalie. But I think it speaks to something bigger. I think the Leafs want to go in to the playoffs with a couple of solid outings under their belt. And what better way to do that than to potentially beat the best team in the NHL on Thursday and then potentially end the playoff dreams of one of their big rivals on Saturday. So there is that. But at the end of the day, they will be the underdogs against the Bruins yet again for a second year in a row. And I think it has a lot of Leaf fans nervous. Now, what I would tell you is this. It actually would not shock me if Toronto won. And if they do win, the chief reason to me will be John Tavares. In that, a year ago, when the Bruins shut down Austin Matthews, the Leafs had really no other way of getting at the Bruins. I mean, it didn't help that Kadri got suspended in that series. But just the mere fact that the Leafs come at the Bruins with two number one center instead of one is a dynamic. I don't think that's getting nearly as much attention, even though it's a pretty obvious thing. I mean, that's why they signed John Tavares last summer, that they would be such a more difficult team to match up against. But John Tavares, as we tape this, 47 goals. So it's going to be interesting to me what Bruce Cassidy does in terms of, you know, is Patrice Bergeron going against Austin Matthews or is he going against John Tavares? And you know, who's Zdeno Chara going up against, you know? And so some more compelling or more difficult decisions for the Bruins matchup-wise than they had a year ago when they beat the Leafs in seven.
I know. It's going to be fun. I can't wait till next week, and we'll do a proper playoff preview podcast. I think we'll try and get that out Monday afternoon sometime once all the matchups are set after Saturday's games. But I was talking to Keith Jones, a longtime analyst player, of course, doing some preview stuff. And he feels that Boston might be the biggest challenge to Tampa in the league. And yet, I'm with you. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I don't disagree. I mean, I think the best three teams in the East are Tampa, Boston, and Washington in that order. But I'm just saying about the Leafs that they are different with John Tavares. I mean, it's a different thing.
Yeah, see, and again, I know we promised that you and I would argue or butt heads, but I'm actually agreeing with you. It's almost like there is so much of a groundswell, so much of a feeling of, oh no, here we go again. I think it actually fits nicely for what Mike Babcock and that team will be preparing for. I think there's almost a benefit to being heavy underdogs, opening on the road, And you add the X factor of John Tavares this year, as you pointed out. I don't think that's a necessarily a bad place for the Toronto Maple Leafs to begin a playoff series, as opposed to, you know, certainly the expectation in Boston that they should beat Toronto. I think it would be different if Toronto was 5 or 6 or 8 points ahead of the Bruins and the expectation was, oh, how will Toronto do against Tampa in the second round? I think this might fit nicely for the way that Mike Babcock is going to have to approach the series. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing for them.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. And, you know, there are players in that Leafs team, too, that are chomping at the bit to redeem themselves for the way they played in that first round against Boston last year. I think of Anderson. I think of Kadri and, a terrible decision with the suspension. Austin Matthews knows he can be better. There's lots of interesting storylines there. But I will say that the thing that has really impressed me about the Boston Bruins this year is that, unlike most teams that have really been slowed down by key injuries, which is normal. I mean, that's what happens. You have key injuries. And the Leafs are an example. I mean, they really hurt them when Gardner went down and Dermott went down. Of course, Dermott's back. But, you know, it did slow them down. Boston, it's amazing to me the way the Bruins had all those injuries for so many, especially in the first half. But, you know, they missed David Pastrnak for a long stretch. They never slowed down. Like, it doesn't seem to matter who's in that Bruins lineup, in or out. It's a machine. And any other year, they're the division winner, probably the conference winner. They happen to be doing all this in a year in which Tampa Bay is doing historical things. So it's, yeah, I mean, listen, the Bruins are an absolute deep juggernaut. And my criticism of the Bruins in recent years has often, unfortunately, fallen on the shoulders of one player. I'm not a big Tuukka Rask playoff fan. and frankly, Tuukka Rask tried to give away Game 7 last year to Toronto, but he got lifted up by his teammates and then lost to Tampa. And, he obviously brought his team to the Cup Final in 13 before losing. In a rather famous way in the last few minutes of play against Chicago. But I'm not, I mean, Tuukka Rask is an excellent goalie. He's been one of the elite net minders in this league for a long time, but he has not given me huge confidence that he's always at his best come that time of year. I could be wrong, but that's always been my feel. And maybe this is the year that he changes he changes my perception of it.
Yeah, no, I think that's it's been an ongoing. Even last year, there was debate in the middle of the season whether Anton Khudobin was actually or should actually be the starter there before he left and signed in Dallas, and where he's been absolutely brilliant backing up the oft-injured Ben Bishop. And I think you've had the same kind of dialogue this season with Yaroslav Halak, who's been lights out for the most part. Coming on in relief of or playing instead of or ahead of at times Tuukka Rask. And I want to ask you, because I think we broaden this. I've been talking to some scouts and analysts as we prepare for the start of the playoffs. And when we talk about playoff goaltending, always the most critical factor, no question. But it does seem like this season there might be more situations where coaches are going to be forced into okay, how long is my leash for my starter? And Bruce Cassidy may be feeling the same thing with Tuukka Rask because Yaroslav Halak has been so good. But I think the same thing maybe exists in Nashville. We know Pekka Rinne's had some struggles in the playoffs the last couple of years, and Juuse Saros has been very, very good, and he has emerged even more this year as the goaltender of the future in Nashville. I think it's fair to say that. What about David Rittich and Mike Smith in Calgary? I talked to a scout today who he believes that Rittich will be the guy to start, that Smith is should be the plan B. Who knows? You look at the goaltending in San Jose, go around, there are probably 5 or 6 teams where the goaltending tandem, and you wrote about this earlier, has been so important to keeping guys fresh and healthy, all those kinds of things. But I think it also sets up the potential for difficult coaching decisions come playoff time. Do you think that we might see more of that this spring than we normally do, where it's, hey, he's my starter, we're going to sink or swim with him?
Yeah, it does seem to present itself in a few more places than normal this year, I would say. And I tell you, the Calgary one is fascinating because the Calgary Flames have ended up blowing away the field in the West, not just in the Pacific, but in the Western Conference, period.
Yeah, it's not close.
They ran away with the Western Conference title, an unbelievable regular season for the Flames, for a team that missed the playoffs last year. Bill Peters will be in the Jack Adams discussion, I'm sure, you know, with Barry Trotz and John Cooper and Rick Tocchet, et cetera.
Rob Brindamore.
Well, yes, Rob Brindamore. And Brad Treliving, the GM of the Flames, I got to think, will be a finalist for the GM award, GM of the year. But can you remember, and I've got a few at the top of my mind here, but I want you to answer first, but a team that is this far ahead of the pack, leading their conference, and yet we're going into the playoffs and people are literally debating whether it should be one goalie or the other starting the playoffs. It's pretty unusual, but it has happened. Now, I got one in mind, but I want you to go first.
Oh, you're brutal. At least you could do is send me a text earlier and tell me you're going to ask me this.
I'll go ahead. Yeah, I'll go while you think. But do you remember the year, I think Chris Pronger may have won the Hart Trophy that year, but the Blues won the President's Trophy. I believe Roman Turek was in net for the St. Louis Blues.
Yes.
And, well, it didn't go well come playoff time. And that just happens, right? It's you know, there are other positions on the team where you have a guy have a great regular season, and if he doesn't quite have the same playoff, at least if he's a defenseman or a forward, you can maybe mask it with the depth you have. But it's hard to do when the guy's your number one goalie. And so it is, and again, it may not be an issue for the Flames. Clearly, it hasn't been during the regular season, no matter who's in goal, but it is pretty unbelievable to have had the kind of year they've had and to have people openly debating which one should start and goal.
Right. Oh, that's true. Well, and in St. Louis is a good example. I mean, the young Jake Allen and Brian Elliott and really good teams in St. Louis when Ken Hitchcock was coaching there. And we've seen coaches try, you know, you can do it. And you can do it deftly to go from goaltender to goaltender, but it is difficult. It is a difficult task for a goaltender or a coach in the NHL to find that rhythm. If you don't have one guy that is your sink or swim guy, and I'm with you. I think it's, there may be more of those this spring.
So. Well, I think of all those great Ottawa teams in and around just pre-cap and post-cap, but the teams that kept losing to Toronto every year, those were unbelievable teams up front and on defense and didn't get enough saves, right?
Yep.
I mean, that was always the Achilles heel. And then, you know, go out and trade for Dominic Hasek and he gets hurt at the Olympics.
Yes.
And so it's the one position that forever has had the kind of impact on the fortunes of a team that just makes GMs lose sleep at night because, you know, you're one injury away to one specific position. It just blows up your entire year. So it's always a big story, but Calgary this year is just a great example of, yeah, they're great, but, hopefully it's not an issue because that is a well-crafted roster with immense talent. And, it's funny. So your guy says David Rittich. I have this sneaking suspicion that Mike Smith is going to get the genie in the bottle just for the amount of time it needs here. And he's going to have a nice little playoff run. That's my prediction.
Oh. All right. Well, we'll talk more about that next week, of course. But I want to, we talked a little bit about Boston and Toronto locked in. We know that San Jose and Vegas are locked in. And you wrote this week that the NHL and the NHLPA have agreed that that the current playoff system will continue to be our playoff system at least for the next year.
Yes, I was going to say, at least for 1 year. There are people reacting to my tweet on Twitter thinking that this is it forever. They literally do not read. They've right. agreed Wait. That the PA is simply
You're
agreed
just finding
that,
this out about Twitter, by the way?
Yeah, I know. So, no, all the PA did, and the PA had to go to its executive board and all the player reps to get the green light, but they've agreed to simply roll over the status quo for another year, and then who knows after that? You know, I think they're probably are enough players that have piped up about it that could be changed, especially with, you know, Seattle coming into the league here in a couple of years. I suspect that the format will be looked at, but for now, for at least another year and maybe more, but at this point, at least for another year, it's the same format.
Right. And that's it. To me, it makes more sense if you are going to adjust it, and whether you're, you know, who knows whether we get to an expanded playoff format or not. But even if you're just going to tweak it back to a 1-8 system in each conference, to me, it makes more sense just to do that when you're introducing the 32nd team in Seattle, that you could sort of roll those things, because you will have a tweak in the divisional alignments and all those kinds of things. So maybe that makes more sense to do it, which would be in 2 years' time. So we'll see how that unfolds.
Yeah, well, and don't forget, Arizona is moving to the Central as part of Seattle going into the Pacific. And I wrote this last week about the playoff format, but it's not just a playoff format. When you change the playoff format, you're also changing the schedule matrix, and that takes a lot of work and planning with the NHL schedule maker, because now you're changing the way, how many games you're playing against each other. All kinds of different things are happening
within the regular season
lead up to the playoffs. Yeah,
just a couple of things we want to tie up before we close our. I'm going to say that the penultimate podcast of the regular season, because our next podcast will be before the start of the playoffs, but after the regular season. So it's the second last one. So I'm going to say that. I don't think there seemed to be very little surprise, and you wrote a little bit about it, but Jeff Blashill being extended as a head coach in Detroit. My sense is that even though maybe early on in the season there was some question, is he the guy to lead the Wings into their new future? But I've been watching them lately. You know what? There's a lot to like about that Detroit team, and I think quite correctly, Jeff Blashill deserves a lot of credit for some of the evolution that has taken place in a very difficult couple of seasons for Detroit. And I take it you weren't surprised that he's going to be the guy moving forward in Detroit.
I'm not surprised he was extended. The only eyebrow raiser for me was the fact that it was only for 2 years. That's not really the norm when coaches get extensions. Generally speaking, there are different circumstances sometimes, yes, but. And I think it makes sense. I mean, I think if you really sit down and examine everything that's going on in Detroit, you understand why it was. I mean, first and foremost, it's that the Red Wings have high standards. And yes, the rebuild is going in the right direction. And yes, Jeff Blashill, I think, is being credited for really bringing along the core, the younger core of that team. But it's not okay to keep missing the playoffs. That's not what the Red Wings are about. So I think the 2-year extension speaks to the idea that this better keep going in the right direction, and they need to get back in. And I'm not going to say he's on notice, but I think everyone's on notice there that they don't want this to be a 5-6 year thing from this point forward. But I also, and maybe this is the elephant in the room, but let's be honest, Ken Holland himself just signed a 2-year extension last summer, right? As GM. So there's a little uncertainty, I think, heading into the summer as to, is Kenny Holland going to stay as GM? Is he going to get promoted upstairs? Is he going to be in the mix for the Seattle job? We all know that everyone in the hockey world thinks Steve Yzerman might come home, but to be honest, there's no actual tangible proof of that, but it's what everyone thinks. Given that the GM position itself doesn't have longevity attached to it in terms of Ken Holland's own position, I think that also was probably a consideration, when dealing with Jeff Blashill. I mean, you don't want to sign your coach to a 6-year extension and then hand over the job to a new GM next summer or the summer after that.
No. Well, we've seen this in various places around the NHL where a GM comes in and a coach has been newly established by either the previous regime or ownership or whatever the dynamics are. And it's, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work, but there is, I think in general, you'd like your GM and your coach to be in lockstep, and you want them to be on the same page, and you want them to have, I think it's important that they have a good working relationship and then a shared vision of what you want your team to look like. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I mean, I think the contract lengths in Detroit do speak to maybe some uncertainty. No one knows how that's going to unfold. And I guess for me, I was I wasn't surprised with the Detroit move, but, and you outlined in your piece this week, I think it's going to be such a fascinating summer in terms of the coaching carousel. It happens every year, right? Coaches get fired, new coaches get hired. It's part of the cycle of life in the NHL. But I want to ask you, when you think of Joel Quenneville and his presence in the marketplace moving forward, and things are going to really start to heat up on a number of coaching fronts as soon as game 82 gets played, but Ottawa didn't even wait. So, you know, next week it's going to start to heat up the coaching discussions and decisions. Is Joel Quenneville similar to when Mike Babcock was available? Do you draw comparisons? Do you think teams will take a lesson, or will have watched what happened as Mike Babcock was deciding on his future, ultimately going to Toronto? Does Joel represent the same kind of thing or a different thing to you?
No, I mean, listen, you're talking about a coach that's going straight to the Hall of Fame one day, Scotty, sure. You know, I guess the one thing to keep in mind with Joel Quenneville is that, you know, he's got another year on his deal paying him north of $6 million. So, you know, that has to get figured out with the Blackhawks, but it also speaks to, you know, the kind of pay scale that he's in, and much like Mike Babcock. And so, you know, it may not be necessarily for every NHL team to be in that ballpark financially. I think that's the first thing you have to consider. You know, I mentioned this last week as a possibility, and only because I'm drawing the dots between past relationships. But if indeed there's a coaching change in Florida, and again, we don't know that there will be one for sure. Bob Bugner is still coach, but my understanding is that the Panthers are, you know, will evaluate the coaching position like other things in the organization after a year that was below expectations in South Florida. But it's hard not to think of a couple of things, and you know, maybe if Del Tal makes a coaching change, can he get his old buddy Coach Q in the fold? And if he gets Coach Q in the fold, it just so happens that there's a Russian free agent superstar winger who loved playing for Coach Q. Yeah, in Artemi Panarin, of course. So could all those things, could the stars all align there in South Florida? Who knows? I mean, maybe that's all fantasy, but I think it's something you got to think about. But there'll be other teams that will want to knock on Joel Quenneville's door too. But as I mentioned in my piece, like, there's a lot of solid veteran brand name power out there, isn't there? Like Alain Vigneault is still out there. And now he's going to coach Canada at the Worlds, and that'll boost his profile again. And Todd McLellan has not forgotten how to coach, despite not being the savior in Edmonton. And, you know, again, I know Rob Blake in LA really likes him, but I think other teams are going to reach out. You know, Dave Tippett is, you know, I think pretty happy with his work in Seattle, but a coach is a coach is a coach. So I suspect if there's a right offer out there, it might be something Dave Tippett would listen to. So that's, you know, just starting with those four, I mean, that's a lot of coaching talent and experience. And so, you know, could they all find their way back?
It is fascinating. I put together a sort of a virtual coaching roundtable, talked to a bunch of current, mostly current, but some former head coaches about coaching in the playoffs, and Dave Tippett was one of them. And among the things he said, because I asked him that very question at the end, I said, is it strange for you when you see the playoffs upcoming? Does it make you antsy to be back in the game? And he said that there is nothing like coaching in the playoffs. And he said, that's why you never say never. So to your point, and I know there have been, you know, some reports out there, maybe the coaching bug is not so, it hasn't been tamped down that far for Dave Tippett, in spite of what is an important role with the Seattle expansion team. You're right. It will be an interesting few months on that front, because if he does throw his hat into the ring, it changes the dynamics in the coaching world again. So, very good. All right. One thing before I wanted to go, I wanted to ask you this. I know that we had one of our colleagues, Tyler Dello, who, an analytics guy, had been doing some work in Edmonton, then he was writing for The Athletic, and now he's been hired by Ray Shiro to be part of the management team with the New Jersey Devils. And so interesting move for him. But I wonder, has a team ever called you and offered you a job? That's what I was curious about. When I saw Tyler going, now, I'm not saying that you and Tyler have the exact same qualifications, but has that ever happened to you? You don't have to say if there was or whatever. But I mean, I was just curious.
No, I've never per se been offered a job. I mean, I've had, I want to be careful here. I've had teams, it's been brought up socially, about my ideas about, later on in my career, would I be interested in trying something different? And, that has come up and frankly, that could be something down the road, but I think I like what I'm doing now, and I like what I'm doing now because, I don't live and die by the result of a game every night. I think there's something to be said for that. When I look at the stress that people throughout hockey organizations go through on a nightly basis, especially for a few teams here in the final week, my goodness.
So you missed a perfect opportunity because if you said, well, if I work for a team, I wouldn't be able to come on the podcast every week with me. So yeah. I just assumed were going.
That would actually be a benefit, actually. But by the way, I have to say, it's very hard for me to admit this, but man, that I love your piece on the Hurricanes and the Bunch of Jerks and all the voices you got in there. I know you were there last week, and I'm hoping that you haven't jinxed them. They're only one point up from the danger zone with two games left. And you basically told Tom Dundon on our podcast last week that they were in. So that's a lot of pressure for you right now. If they miss the playoffs, you may never be welcome back to Carolina the rest of your career.
Yeah, my rally privileges may be revoked if the Canes fall out of it. But they had a huge win against Toronto, I love the emotion, and it's been fun to watch the fans on Twitter and to follow up to the piece that there really is. It's completely different there than any time I think in a decade, and I think mm-hmm. it's great to see because they deserve to have some good news. And there are lots of people who worked very hard and worked through very difficult situations and really put a lot on the line to make this happen. So no cheering in the press box, my friend, but it would be better for the Athletic if the Carolina Hurricanes made it. That's all I'm saying.
Better for you anyway. That's for sure. All right. I got to run. I got other stuff to do. Enough already.
I know, it's perfect. Well, next time we talk, we'll be talking playoff matchups, my friend. Good work.
Right on, right on.